Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keane, always with Michael McKee. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. Joe Quinlan with us, Bank of America and U.S. Trust. Joe, the basic idea here, correct me if I'm wrong, is Google and Facebook crush Yahoo. Can you set up a portfolio where you own number one and number two, you own Hertz and you own Avis in every sector that you're in?
I mean, you could, Tom, but I'd be very careful in that because you have to overlay, if you're going to do automobiles, you have to overlay some Japanese companies, German companies, same with capital goods. You have to start sprinkling in, when it comes to technology, some of the Chinese internet stocks because they're doing pretty well in terms of capability. So you can do that, but you're looking large cap, you might buying more value than growth. If you want the growth, you got to go small and mid cap.
Well, the other thing, too, is if you're buying those companies, you're talking about the biggest companies. So you're not going to necessarily get much return because of the law of large numbers. I mean, their share prices aren't going to move dramatically.
Not dramatically, but and you could also, Microsoft, they're back, but there was a time when they were quite the laggard for relative to the rest of this industry. So that could happen again at some point.
You just made me think, though, because if you're buying those companies, you're probably not going to lose a lot of money. You're not going to gain a lot of money. It's a little bit like investing in defensive stocks in the tech sector. Are there any dividend-paying stocks that are worth having just for the dividend appreciation? At least you're getting something out of it? Because we always talk about dividends. Okay, you're going to buy an industry, you're going to buy a utility. But is there anything in tech like that?
Not really, Mike. I mean, if you're looking for dividend, you're looking for income, stay traditionally, whether it's the pharmaceuticals, the capital goods, the industrials, the transports. But, technology, you want more growth. That's your bent in that sense. Doesn't mean you can't get it once in a while, one-off dividend payers. But if you're looking for income, no, you got to play safer.
I'm looking here at the press release, which is almost a parody of MBA speak. From good people, Mr. Armstrong, who, folks, full disclosure, I consider to be the transaction of a few years back, the Verizon AOL transaction. Armstrong looked like a genius. And, of course, Ms. Mayer with comments as well, Lowell McAdam of Verizon, is, well, but the word that permeates this discussion is scale. Help our listeners worldwide, the sophisticated CFA types and people that maybe have never heard that word. What is scale? And why do we care?
You need scale, Tom, to drive the demand, drive the top-line growth, help reduce the cost, pull in from different competencies. So, any company that has scale, not just in the United States, but globally, has that competitive advantage when it comes to reaching new consumers, driving organic growth, and leveraging, lowering your
costs. Then how does that work in what I'm going to collegially call a triopoly of Google, Facebook, and what's it going to be, Mike Verhoeven?
They're going to change their name, but they don't tell us to what. Let's hope. There's some talk that Mondelez might become available if they change their name.
I'm not sure how that all works out in that sense. But you're seeing a lot of the technology companies kind of step into each other's space, and I think that's what's becoming more interesting. Is Apple a healthcare company? Is Google going to be a car company? It's very interesting. It's very disruptive, and it's going to be interesting. The old line players, if they're still here.
We're going to drag Clay Christensen into this. My word. If I look at right now, Mike, just to help everybody here with Yahoo's. First of all, it's a tiny company. Can we remind ourselves that they only are like $5 billion or maybe $4 billion of revenue? So basically, they sold this dog at, one point whatever times revenue. I stand corrected if I'm wrong. They do under $1 billion in EBITDA, folks. That's when you go down the income statement and you bring over a little bit of a balance sheet adjustment. Their net income, Mike, is like, the income of the New York Rangers.
That's not the reason for the deal, obviously. I'm just wondering, Joe, do you think basically what Verizon is getting is the ad platform, the metrics, the patents, the way they can sell advertising. Does that add enough to Verizon? I mean, I assume that's such a small deal that it's a rounding error for them in terms of their cash. But
I'm not sure. I haven't looked at the numbers. I don't follow the industry or the company. But it does, you know, companies are paying for that sliver or of a core competency that they don't have. Rather than developing it, you can buy it if it's the price is right. I don't know where the pricing is, but that's what they're doing. They're buying a specific core competency that fits into their portfolio.
Yeah, I mean, $4.83 billion, it's not a lot of money.
Well, like you said, I mean, it's one of the smaller deals of the year.
Yeah, but if they get the advertising, maybe that helps. Now,
and they're paying cash.
And they're paying cash, yeah. The interesting thing then is that they leave behind the Alibaba estimate, the Alibaba part. And that, I mean, maybe you want to own that company as opposed to Verizon at this point.
I think, you know, Alibaba is, I think, one of those up-and-coming. They're not upcoming. They've already arrived. Chinese internet stock that's going global. They have a very good global presence that's building out. Reminds me of some of these Chinese stocks now that when in Japan took 1960s and 70s, where they started small, they got some traction, then became big players later on.
At this point, do you have any idea what would happen to a Marissa Meyer, or is it too early to speculate?
I have no idea.
I mean, I, as I understand it, Tom, there was some report she's going to get a $57 million golden parachute. So I guess she's not going to be in any hurry to come back to work.
I said to Alex Sherman 20 minutes ago with a chart of Yahoo, look at where the price of the stock was when she walked in the door, and look where the price is now. And I just don't get it. I mean, the job of a CEO is to create shareholder value. Was it ugly along the way? Yes, but not that ugly. I mean, she created, I don't know if she earned these large pay packages that people are talking about, but the fact is a lot was created. A lot of value was created.
Are we looking, Joe, at M&A as any kind of significant driver for what you want to invest in right now? I mean, obviously this deal captures everybody's attention, but as we mentioned, it's a small one. Are you looking to M&A? Where is it in the spectrum of things you're looking at these days?
Mike, one area is energy, in the sense that we've got some companies that are pretty
going belly up.
Yeah, belly up, distressed assets. We're looking for companies, the stronger companies, to kind of buy some distressed assets at very cheap prices, and it adds to their portfolio and future earnings. So that's number one. Maybe in the capital goods sector as well, you know, the larger companies buying that one core competency. So those two in particular, some mergers, acquisition, transportation. Whether it's the airlines, trucking. So what we're looking for, like, companies that have the cash, need that specific core company that helps drive their earnings. But energy, number one.
We went through a period where everybody was looking at M&A as a way to try to make money. And it does seem to have kind of faded a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it makes money for the financiers and the lawyers in that sense. When it comes to, like, the ultimate results, well, that takes time. So, you know, in some cases, no. In some cases, yes. But, you know, it is a time factor.
What we try to do here, folks, is slice through the BS within the message. And there's a little bit of that out there. I, again, Michael McKee, go back to the idea of the train wreck that she inherited. And it was years and years. You used to sit there in awe. I mean, 22 years, 24 years old, when the two guys at Stanford invented this thing. And it was gangbusters for a while. And then you'd sit in awe, awe. Here's and how they blew it up.
Here's a For What It's Worth headline. It's just a few words, but it says, Yahoo, Meyer plans to stay. What she's going to do, I don't know. Part of that company she doesn't have to run anymore, so maybe she'll run this investment house that they're talking about with the remainder, which is basically the Alibaba shares and the patents, the non-core patents, they say, the stuff that doesn't run the advertising that they had to sell to Verizon. Yeah. Let's ask Joe Quinlan from U.S. Trust. Is there anything to buy in housing these days? It's been mixed, and all of a sudden now it's getting better.
It's getting better. I mean, you know, the housing, I think, of like Lowe's and Home Depot, you know, the traditional. I think, you know, we're looking at good housing. I mean, look where the interest rates, cost of capital, millennials. I do think millennials are going to like buy homes at some point. Here in the United States, it's a relatively young population. We create over 1 million new households every year. So, but I think it's kind of steady as you go. I kind of like more like kind of the Home Depots and Lowe's in that space.
Yeah, so fix up the house rather than.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a trade that's been out there for some time, but you know, I think that's the space you want to be in. And you know, the appliance makers are doing better, the carpets, but yeah, I think it continues. I get a lot of pushback. You know, we're old, aging, we're not buying homes. That's not true. This is a young population, a lot of household formation.
What are you avoiding right now? I mean, it's an odd market.
Yeah, ironically, Tom, you know, utilities, telecom. I mean, I know we like the dividend payers and we got to get paid while we wait, but you know, they're just too expensive. We can find better dividend paying stocks in capital goods, transportation, and other places.
Mike, I'm trying to get up here. The dividend for Verizon, 4.03% with a next to no growth rate, and the stock is enjoying 45 to 56. So just this year, you've picked up $11 of share price off 45, captured a Snapola dividend with no prospects of dividend growth.
I wonder if what we're seeing with Verizon stock, Joe, is what we've seen maybe with some other stocks like this. People are betting on the possibilities of the internet and these things as opposed to certainly actual revenues.
Well, I think so, Michael, but at the same time, maybe they're looking at their bills that they get too from the cable companies and you know, they think like, wow, I'm paying that much and it's this cost for this service and it might be falling to the bottom line. So it's a little bit of both, but you know, the earnings backdrop is going to have to be pretty supportive to maintain those dividends.
Now joining us, Scott Galloway, Executive Vice President and Critique of Yahoo at New York University. Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You know, you've been way out front on this in what I would call respectful and constructive criticism. We just heard from Tim Armstrong and Marty Walden as they rationalize this transaction. Our basic theme with our Alex Sherman is, why is Verizon doing this? What's the desperation behind this transaction?
Tom, I think this is a good thing. I think this is peace with honor for a great company that's gone from 13% of all digital marketing in 2009 to 3.5%. But as digital marketing continues to grow and there's a duopoly, Verizon sees 100 million handsets. They see a great leader in Tim Armstrong. They see a market that's growing. And they see a company they can pick up for about $5 billion. I usually don't like most acquisitions. I like this one. I think it's a good idea. I think this is good for Yahoo employees. I think it's good for Verizon. I think it's good for the ecosystem, good for the planet.
Does Verizon keep all of what there is of Yahoo now? I mean, they clearly want the advertising algorithms. Do they want all the content and the search functions and that sort of stuff?
I doubt it. I think they will put more management discipline on the company than has previously been applied. People would probably say the disease that's afflicted Yahoo over the last 10 years was dancing in too many parties. And Verizon is an incredibly well-run company. Tim Armstrong has ended up being kind of the most talented managerial ex-Googler. My guess is that they're gonna streamline this thing and focus on, you know, bri-roll video, some of the programmatic media, and the fact that Yahoo still gets a billion people. I mean, the population of Europe, the U.S., and out in Latin America show up to a Yahoo site every year. 225 million email subscribers. Yahoo Finance is a fantastic product. So I think they'll pair some stuff, but there's a lot of assets here.
This is Verizon. This is a $228 billion company. This is a rounding error for them in terms of, I mean, this is the change in the couch for them to pay for this. So we've talked a lot about what it will do for Yahoo. What does it end up mattering? You know, how much does it end up mattering to Verizon in the long run?
Well, if you look at what's growing in digital marketing, or in general, where is the growth in all of media and advertising? It's It's really two words. It's we're talking about mobile, and we're talking about digital marketing. And Verizon with AOL and now Yahoo has those assets and is now technically a viable competitor to Facebook and Yahoo, who have, Facebook and Google, who have 15%, 40% share. And now with the acquisition, Verizon has 5%, and it's no longer a duopoly. There is a third player here with some heft and, you know, some assets. So I think Verizon gets, as you said, for not an incredibly dilutive acquisition, an opportunity to go toe-to-toe with two players in an ecosystem that's growing, and they have some outstanding assets. We're staring at our phone screen now more than any other screen, and Verizon knows where you are, has the handsets, and now has some great assets and some great leadership to take a run at the duopoly. I think it's a good strategy.
Let me just point out quickly, Tom, that when Yahoo hit its peak market cap of $125 billion at the start of 2000, Verizon didn't exist. Still Bell Atlantic. Wow. 6 months later, they bought GTE and formed Verizon.
Scott, you know, I look at this, and I think, again, your perspective has been really, really wonderful. I'm looking at ad blocking, just as, you know, to use a Clay Christensen phrase, the ultimate disruptive force. Do you have a legitimate confidence that a no-name Verizon, Yahoo, Verahu, whatever it's going to be, can compete with Facebook and far more can compete with Google? I just don't buy it for a minute. I mean, I get it's a triopoly, but they are, I mean, this is not Hertz and Avis. They are massively a third-round player.
Yeah, it's a fair point, Tom. They are RC Cola, the Coke and Pepsi, right? So ad blocking, you know, I generally believe that in general, advertising has become a tax that poor people pay. To your point, wealthy, technologically literate people are opting out advertising. But there are some assets here that people do want. People do like Yahoo content. Verizon does have a screen in 100 million people's pockets. We call it privacy invasion. Millennials call it relevance, as long as you can serve them ads that are relevant to them. And with these assets, specifically geo-targeting, 100 million phones, and some really good Yahoo content and AOL content, they have a fighting chance here, Tom. And personally, I have a bias towards this deal, because I think when two players are getting 90 cents on every dollar of incremental digital spend, and Google, it's good to see a third player. So I'm hoping this works. It's also good news for the Yahoo employees. Yahoo has continued to get great people, and they've had very poor leadership, and they're about to get great leadership. So I think it's a good thing for the employees of Yahoo who have been through, you know, been through heck and back.
Now, Tim Armstrong, to his great credit, mentioned SG&A and the dreaded synergy. What will be the synergy? What's your experience on the synergy path of someone like Yahoo?
Synergy, you mean in terms of synergy?
9,400 bodies. How many go out the door?
Well, I know one that's going to leave. But I don't. You got to think, let me put it this way. You got to think there's going to be fewer. Most of the strategies proposed by the private equity guys was what I call a slash and burn, and a recognition this was a mature company, and it could probably, I saw one deck of a potential acquirer saying that you could take this company down to 2,000 people and hold on to 60 to 80% of the revenues. So I don't know the exact number, but I'm comfortable saying it's going to be less.
Scott, thank you so much. We greatly value your perspective on technology and media, and particularly your good work over the recent number of months on Yahoo. This day where Verizon will take out Yahoo. Scott Galloway is at New York University. We make a hard right, a segue over to technical analysis, with one of our most popular guests, Louise Yamada, technical research. Louise, the hallmark of Yamada chart analysis is a long-term X-axis. You love to look at long charts. If you take a bull market back to 1998, can you confirm we're still in a bull market?
Well, we certainly have tried to follow what we're seeing in terms of any changes that take place. We had been pretty much concerned about a bear market, and we saw 20% down on so many areas. But over the past couple of months, some of the patterns started to turn up and suggest that maybe the market could go higher, and we have seen breakouts through these year-plus consolidations, now we could call them, rather than tops. And we have to acknowledge that there's an extension here to the bull market. Yeah.
There is technical improvement. And, folks, this is going to be a little bit geeky. Charts on radio are sport. And the way I would do this, Louise, is to use a word that you and I use, which is distribution, which is the back and forth within a pattern. What does the distribution tell you now about all those blue chip stocks all of us love to own right now?
Well, the distribution pattern took place from late 2014 to 2015. And as we moved into the end of the first quarter of 2016, we started to see an evaporation of some of that distribution and more a pattern of accumulation. There, for the New York Stock Exchange in particular, you've seen the distribution pattern, and then you started to see the beginnings of what looked like a potential reverse head and shoulder bottom, which means that you've had accumulation coming into place over the past month.
Can you be comfortable in the market now? People that don't do charts are dying to know from Louise Yamada, can they have comfort in holding things that have been good for them over the last, well, 5 years, back to the bull market?
Oh, sure. I think that if something has continued up, and there are quite a few stocks that barely recognized the period of distribution and continued to go higher without a blip. But I think that one of the rules of thumb is always to have a move up, a mental stop loss to protect your profits and recognize it and respect it if the pattern reverses and that stop loss is taken out.
You are a wonderful pure technician. Can you see Janet Yellen in your charts?
I wish we could. I think maybe the only one that suggests something might be coming is the two-year note, which broke the uptrend very briefly and has bounced back up above it. We had another breach of the uptrend a little bit earlier, but you have an uptrend that's in place for the two-year note. The 10-year's been a little bit more disappointing, but the two-year might be suggesting here that there could be something coming down the line.
Well, what would you like to suggest that would be? We need to get you in trouble in the economic world today. What would that be?
Well, I'm inclined to think that we should be raising once again, but that's my personal opinion.
We like
and
your
maybe that's what the 2 years saying.
We like your personal opinion. Louise Yamada with us, folks. Louise Yamada, technical research. I've already had emails. Yes, we will speak to Ms. Yamada about oil and gold as well, particularly oil, which is the word I use, folks, when it's a technical jumble is soup. And there's a lot of soupy charts out there not giving me much.
You learned
trend.
That in CFA.
That's CFA level four. You get that soup. Louise Yamada with us on charts. David Rosenberg coming up here in a bit. That's good as well. Rosenberg after Yamada. That's a very cool thing. Louise, oil. To me, it is massive soup. It's massively indeterminate. Can you make a directional call on oil?
Well, over the past year, more and more, the development of a potential reverse head and shoulders bottom. So we've been looking here for the potential for a pullback toward 42.40 to complete a right shoulder. If 40 doesn't hold, then all bets are off and perhaps the formation is aborted. But at the moment, I think that we're looking at the possibility for a bit more of a pullback for the price. If it holds 40 and starts turning up, then perhaps the consolidation will continue and a breakout through 50 would suggest higher prices. But if 40 doesn't hold, then maybe you're going to have to go back and test the low. At the moment, we're constructive.
The low was in the high 20s. Do we go that far if we break through 40?
It's a possibility. It's a possibility. We're not looking for 40 to break. You've got a strong 200-day moving average right there at 40. It could slip just a little bit lower. But at the moment, we're following this potential constructive pattern. We'll see how it forms.
Mike, we had a potential constructive pattern this weekend. One of the children actually did the dishes.
There you go.
That's what potential constructive
is. Louise, I'm curious. We've been talking to a lot of strategists lately and asking them, in this world where everything seems to be breaking down and models seem to be breaking down, you know, do your models work? How do you figure out the value of something? And almost all of them say it's really hard. And I'm wondering if it has affected the charts in the same way, that we seem to have gone into a different kind of environment, maybe a secular change in something. Has the same thing happened for you when you're looking at the charts?
Well, since we follow price, we just take what is given to us and adjust our opinions accordingly. But I think that there is certainly a once-in-a-lifetime or century problem in the fact that we've got so much with negative interest rates. I'm not comfortable with that at all, and I think it's shifting the way people think. And we've been suggesting, and I did a little editorial last month, suggesting whether the stock market isn't where we're experiencing inflation with these breakouts. And it's not being factored into the inflation quotient, so to speak. And we're seeing the utilities and the telecoms and the consumer staples doing well, breaking out, giving us monthly momentum buy signals. And you've got to ask the question, are we looking at something with them that's offensive rather than defensive this time because of the unique situation?
What is it like trying to figure out what's going on in a Fed world, central bank world, put it that way, where nobody quite knows what the central banks are going to do. So that influence isn't as easy to figure out. I mean, it used to be the Fed would tell you what they were going to do and did it. Now they tell you what they're going to do and then they don't do it.
Well, I don't think we have a chart for the Fed, unfortunately.
But in terms of the influence of interest rates on stock prices.
Oh, I think that because the interest rates are so low and even negative, you're probably getting foreign money coming in, too, as a safety factor here, and that's possibly right behind what's happening with gold.
Louise, what do you do with overpriced blue-chip stocks? We all know the story. Dividend growth, an 18 multiple became a 25 multiple. They're either rich, 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 get out of the way, they're going to go down, or there you hold them because they're growing their dividend and there's nothing else to buy. What do the charts of, you know, you can name the companies rather than me, those name brand dividend growing blue chips, what does Louise Yamada do with them?
We have to follow what the price is giving us. And as you mentioned, I think you mentioned Colgate before, breakout through an extended consolidation. You keep going with it and raising your stop loss. That's the only advice we can give for the individual investors is to protect your capital, keep moving it up until the story isn't there anymore.
Louise Yamada, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it.
David Rosenberg is chief economist and chief strategist at Gluskin Sheff. He joins us now. We don't have any numbers to talk about, but we do have a Fed meeting to talk about, David. And the numbers that we have seen in recent weeks have started to come in better than forecast. The surprise indexes are all higher. Does the Fed get through this meeting without suggesting maybe we raise rates sooner rather than later?
Well, you know, I think we have to put it into perspective. The data has certainly come in above expected, but the expectations were pretty low to begin with. So, you know, look, when you take a look at the Atlanta Fed model, it's pointing to 2.4% growth after, call it around 1% in the first quarter. So we're still averaging out very tepid growth rates as far as I'm concerned. I think that, the last Fed meeting was a week before Brexit. There was heightened global political concerns. Markets were certainly a lot more jittery than they are now, with the major averages, you know, testing their all-time highs. I think that the one sentence that comes out of the statement is, of course, the one that talked about job growth diminishing, especially after the last non-farm payroll report. The consensus seems to be that the Fed's going to tip its hat towards signaling a rate hike, you know, as early as September. I'm not so sure about that, but, you know, if you're going to ask me, do I think that this particular statement will be more upbeat on a macro basis, and certainly in terms of what financial conditions have done benchmarked against what we had in mid-June, you know, that I'm full square with. But the Fed, I think the core Fed policymakers signaling that they've got an itchy finger right now, I'm not so sure. And if they do, I think it'll be caveated with so many other items that have to happen that I don't think that it's going to really spin the dial that much in terms of Fed futures contracts or the bond market in terms of where it's priced right now.
Well, you think they just kind of want to give themselves optionality and not have the markets pricing in a first quarter 2017 move. They're not going to say the word September in their statement.
No, but they can always find some sort of language. My sense is that, you know, is it the tail or is it, you know, or is it the head of the dog here in terms of chasing what? You know, everybody talks about that the Fed now has to become less dovish or more hawkish. But the reality is that a good part of what the markets have done is partly because, you know, the Fed, after pledging apparently to raise rates four times this year at the beginning of the year, has gone back on that, and the markets appropriately have taken out those tightenings. So you can't have it both ways. If the market, for whatever reason, starts to price in that the Fed's going to raise rates, and of course it's just rhetoric right now by some Wall Street economists and strategists, the futures have priced in more of it, but certainly nowhere close to better than 50-50 on a move this year. But if the market starts to price in the Fed, what happens next? The U.S. dollar starts to strengthen, and if you remember, go back to the beginning of the year, that was one of the factors that was undermining the outlook for corporate earnings. It was causing the ISM to retreat. And so my sense is that, you know, the economy is certainly doing better than it was. It's still not doing great. And I think the big surprise, actually, is where inflation is going to end up in the next several months.
Yeah, that's right where I wanted to go, David. I thought you've been brilliant on this. And, of course, the famous Rosenberg line, inflation is just a forecast, not a reality. And then you go over to an idea of reflation. If we don't have inflation and we're worried about importing into our country disinflation and deflation, is it possible for any government to truly reflate their economy?
Well, there is certainly room to reflate, you know, through fiscal policy, which hasn't been done really in any, outside of, say, China. I guess you could also say Japan. Japan's running a fiscal deficit of 7.5% of GDP. But, you know, when you have a debt-to-GDP of 250%, you get to what's called Bacardian equivalence, where the additional fiscal stimulus just gets saved and doesn't get spent. Lots of talk, obviously, among the two candidates in the U.S. As to how far fiscal policy will get stimulated next year. But, again, you know, that's next year's story, and who knows how much stimulus we end up getting through the House, no matter who wins. So, you know, my sense is this, just looking at the data. You know, here we've had, you know, oil prices double off the lows, and the headline inflation rate is 1%. I mean, seriously, is that all you get from oil prices doubling from the lows? And what's happening now is you're getting the vigorous response in terms of multiple unit construction. Rental rates are starting to peak out. Vacancy rates in the apartment sector are starting to bottom out and hook higher. And the whole inflation story in the past year has only been, really, it's been imputed rent. And actual rents in the CPI data, which is, what, 40% of the index. You strip out the rental part of this inflation story, and the CPI is running negative 0.2 on a year-over-year basis.
Yeah.
I think that becomes a lot more apparent in the next several months. And, you know, so people will be talking about, well, the Fed may not have reached its unemployment goal, but meanwhile, you know, inflation is going to start to recede again.
David Rosenberg with us, and I really urge you folks to hear our podcast with Joachim Fels of PIMCO as well, who's, like Mr. Rosenberg, speaks of shadow rates, which are way below where the actual visible inflation rate is. David, you are the ultimate just the facts economist. What facts have you learned about negative interest rates?
Well, I think what we learned about negative interest rates is that ultimately all they end up doing is putting a tax on the banks. And if you're ultimately wanting to generate a healthy economy, I think you need to have a healthy banking sector. So I'm actually happy that this is not a policy that's been transmitted to North America, nor do I think it will be. And so far, I don't see any evidence that it's done anything to recreate confidence or economic acceleration, you know, within the broader European economy, especially the Eurozone. So to me, it's a If you're going to stimulate policy, again, I'd rather that we moved away from strictly monetary towards some fiscal response that ultimately will lie with Germany, which actually is running budgetary surpluses right now. But negative interest rates right now, to me, is a flawed monetary policy.
The Fed doesn't like it. It's extremely unlikely that they would ever adopt it. But is it possible that the markets could push negative interest rates upon us?
Well, I'm not so sure that it's something that the markets are pushing. One of the reasons why, I suppose, that you haven't moved to a situation here in the U.S. or Canada where rates have gone negative is because, central banks here are no longer in the QE game. You have a situation where the two parts of the world that have negative yields are the two areas of the world, Japan and, say, the euro area, where the central banks there are still aggressively involved in quantitative easing. In fact, to a point where, the ECB is so aggressive now in the corporate bond market that you have, in some cases, short-term corporate credit trading at a negative yield. So if you're going to convince me that things are going to get so bad in the U.S. That the Fed is going to re-embark on quantitative easing, take out more duration and safety out of the marketplace at a time when you have ongoing captive demand for fixed income out of insurance companies and pension funds, I suppose you can get to that situation where the markets push you, but it's not going to just be it's not going to be a demand issue. It's going to be that the central bank here follows what they're doing abroad in taking so much fixed income product out of the marketplace. I don't exactly have a very bullish prognosis for the U.S. economy, but I don't exactly believe that things are going to get that bad that the Fed's going to have to reenact quantitative easing to that extent.
Well, I'm just wondering if the kind of buying pressure from overseas that we have seen keeps the pressure on. And you've got a call from the folks at Citigroup that we get to a 1% rate on the 10-year by the first quarter of next year.
Well, that's, I wouldn't rule that out entirely. We did something I wasn't even anticipating. I thought that the lows in the 10-year yield were put in July 2012 when we got to around 140. And, of course, we broke through that a few weeks ago. So I think we're in a new and lower range on the 10-year note yield. If we do get to 1%, which, again, I wouldn't rule out. It's not my base case. But it would take, I think, more than what you're talking about right now. It would take more than just the pull of lower global bond yields. It would take a relapse in the U.S. economy to get to those sorts of levels. Take a look at what it took to get to 140. It took 140. It took a recessionary scare from a very poor May payroll number, and of course, the geopolitical risk coming right out of the Brexit. So you'd have to have really a combination of things go awry to get yields all the way down to 1%. That said, 1% isn't negative. And look, you go back to that whole period for about a decade in the early 40s to the early 50s, the Fed pegged the long bond yield at that point for a decade at 2.5%. If the Fed ever wanted to abandon, say, its policy of targeting its balance sheet, which is what it was doing under QE, the targeting long-term rates, it could easily do that as well. But let's just call it for what it is. If interest rates were really the panacea for accelerating economic growth, well, you've had that in Japan now for a quarter century. Where's the acceleration? You've had unbelievably easy monetary conditions in the Eurozone. Where's the acceleration in economic growth, for that matter, in the United States? So we have to really think about something else, which is going to be through either regulatory policy or through tax and spending policy. To me, the answer really lies in fiscal policy. So we can talk here theoretically and academically about negative interest rates, but the proof is in the pudding. The European economy is still not going anywhere despite this unprecedented monetary relief. So the answer is going to lie with fiscal policy.
David, you synthesize economics and equities. We've got a number of people that do that. Joe Quinlan on earlier does much the same thing. Are you comfortable owning dividend-growing big U.S. companies?
I think that theme is going to remain intact, until bond yields rise on a sustained basis. So, look, we have an unusual situation now where it's not just where the dividend yield of the S&P is above the 10-year note, it's above the long bond yield. I don't know of a time that it's happened before. I think the utility stocks are way overpriced, and you could argue that maybe Staples Telecom to a lesser extent. If we're talking about areas of the stock market that generate stable cash flows. Well, that's what the baby boomers want. That's not going to go away. You know, we have 1.5 million people that are going to be turning the age of 70 for the next 15 years. They have a 50-50 chance of making it to 85 or 90, and they're going to need to have an income flow that the bond market doesn't provide. So, yeah, the answer is in the stock market. It doesn't mean you got to be in utilities. You know, you could be in regional banks. You could be in the REITs. You could be in the MLPs. There are vast areas of the market beyond just the traditional safe areas like utilities mm-hmm. that you can spin off a cash flow. Even some tech names that didn't even have a dividend policy 15 years ago were paying out yields of 2.5% to 3.5%. So the answer is yes. I think the dividend theme doesn't mean you've got to stay in one sector right. for 12 or 24 months, but that the dividend income theme in the equity market is going to be a pervasive one for some time to come.
David, thank you so much. It's fascinating to talk to Mr. Rosenberg, Michael, about the parsing of price change. To review, inflation we all get. Disinflation is not down. Disinflation is less inflation. Deflation is priced down. And honest to God, Michael, reflation is essentially undefined. There isn't really a formal description of what societies end up needing to do.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. There's a few other things, odd things like that.
Yeah.
But after all these years, you still got to walk through inflation, disinflation, deflation, reflation. How do you define stagflation?
No, stagflation is with the economy not growing very fast and inflation rising.
Yeah. My answer is a recession without the NBER involved. Just one opinion. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Michael McKee is at McConomy. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.